Deep into History is independent and proudly listener-supported. Before we begin, I'd like to thank my newest patron, who went to patreon.com/deepintohistory to keep this experience we share ad-free and thriving. You can also support the show directly on Spotify and starting this week directly on Apple Podcasts. And I could use your help now more than ever before. Thus, it warms my heart to welcome Preston, my new historian. I salute you and thank you from the center of my being. This is Deep Into History, and I'm your host, Arjun Hundo. A strange time is upon us, people pounding pumpkin spice in the hopes of gaining the courage to howl at the moon. Feral Kennedys terrorizing the wilderness of the Northeast, and one has pounced and seeks to rise to power. There is a reason for this, of course, for we are fast approaching the hour when the veil between our realm and the realm of the underworld is at its thinnest. A time when many believe ghosts, specters, and far darker things are free to show themselves at their most powerful and walk amongst us mortals. You may think, nay, even believe, that such thoughts are silly modern contrivances, a distraction from the mundane and unfulfilling nature of life in late-stage capitalism. But you would be wrong. Hauntings, spirits, ghosts, and yes, even the undead have existed, well, as long as we have. However, humans exhibit behavior that we cannot attribute to the supernatural. I speak of our darker tendencies, like the lust for wealth, fame, power, and to achieve these, be willing to do anything, including harming others, kill, or even commit mass murder. Inner demons, the worst impulses of humanity unleashed. The account of the dealer of death we are about to experience comes down to us from a few passages from three historians, Cassius Dio, Tacitus, and Suetonius. Misogynistic sources, to say the least. Not at all a rarity in ancient times. Thus, I've used the approach I use for all powerful women in our tales. I triangulated the ancient sources, blended them with the thoughts of modern historians, and synthesized them into a narrative. In order to give our tale to be the authentic flavor it truly deserves, I've expanded the scope so you can understand the world that she was born into, and how she turned that world upside down. So, let's set the scene. The Republic has fallen. Rome is now the Empire, ruled over by the Julio-Claudian dynasty that was established by Julius Caesar's nephew Octavian, who came to be called Augustus. He brilliantly used myth, religion, and to a certain extent fantasy to cultivate an aura of the divine around the ruling family, thus subtly projecting the divinity that all believed had belonged to the Republic onto himself and his family. Careful never to make the critical error of claiming kingship, let alone godhood, concepts that were still abhorrent to the public, he took the title Princeps, meaning most eminent or first citizen, and instead used small rural religious cults to promote his divine lineage, so that it appeared that these ideas were flowing into the city from outside of Rome. A king or emperor in all but name, Augustus had every intention of passing his power onto a blood relation and establish a royal dynasty. And if he was de facto emperor, his wife Livia was empress, who wielded significant influence and power through her husband, but also in her own right. Women, even those of the most powerful noble families, were expected by societal norms to be background players, running the household, bearing then raising children, supporting their husband's actions, and in public were expected to be demure, wholesome, and above all silent on matters of state. As Romana Princeps, First Lady of the Empire, Livia carefully walked that line, wielding significant influence, but careful not to flaunt her power openly and thus draw the wrath of Roman men, always portraying the ideal of Roman womanhood, the standard which Augustus had promoted and set early in his reign. But one thing he may not have fully considered is how female virtus, in his own definition, required a mother to promote her child's interests, ideally provided that they exhibited aptitude and intelligence from an early age, so that they would grow to become the future leaders of the state. And for Romana Princeps Livia, with two sons from her previous marriage, promoting their interests would mean making them the heirs to the empire. Thus, the succession struggle within the family was complex and indeed convoluted, resulting in all of Augustus's would-be heirs, his direct blood relations, tragically, and sometimes suspiciously dying. This gave rise to the notion that Livia had them poisoned or killed because it was her son, Tiberius, who became the second emperor of Rome. Enter Agrippina the Younger, born in 15 in the Common Era, in modern Germany, where her father's legions were on military campaign. Her mother, Agrippina the Elder, and her father, who earned the title Germanicus for his famous victories, were devoted to each other, inseparable. Thus they stayed together even while he was commanding a war. They were members of the imperial family held in the highest regard by the public. She was one of their 9 children, only 6 of whom survived much past childhood. Her father was Emperor Tiberius's official heir. However, his fame and popularity became seen as a threat, and it is widely believed that the emperor had him poisoned. After his death, the child Agrippina was taken to Rome and raised among the powerful and politically skilled elder women of her family. Her mother and 2 older brothers were soon exiled and would die because the paranoid emperor believed they were plotting against him. At the very young age of 13, Agrippina was married to an absolute brute of a man to cement a political alliance between the emperor and his noble family. His name was Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus. His last name means red beard, as their family had produced nearly exclusively ginger offspring for most of Roman history. He was often drunk, violent, and sociopathic. For example, he killed his freedmen for refusing to drink as much as he was told to. He ripped out the eye of an equestrian in the Forum Romanum for criticizing his failure to repay his debts, and famously rode down a child who was playing with a doll on the Appian Way because he would not slow his chariot. Also, he was at least 25 years older than his child bride, Agrippina, who after a lavish public wedding in Rome, was taken and secluded in his country estate. As we can imagine, the young girl had to use every strategy, tactic, and trick taught to her by the women of the imperial family to simply survive her marriage to a man who at nearly any other point in Roman history would have been exiled or worse for his behavior. Agrippina was soon pregnant, so she sought out oracles and rural sibyls to discover her child's future. Every answer was the same: that she carried a son, and he would become emperor, and then kill his mother. To which she replied, "Let him kill me, provided he is emperor." After their son, named Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, who we know as Nero, was born in 37 Common Era, friends and family came to their villa to congratulate his father. He replied, "I don't believe anything that is the product of me and Agrippina could possibly be good for the world." Life outside their villa was changing, when after a ruthless reign of intrigue, suspicion, murder, and injustice to anyone he even imagined as a threat, Emperor Tiberius died that same year, and Agrippina's older brother Caligula ascended to the throne. Soon followed by the death of her husband, from what most historians suspect was most likely liver disease from his excessive drinking. Yet due to the venomous politics of the imperial family, in Rome, rumor spread that it was Agrippina that had poisoned him, and some plebs whispered, "She's dangerous." The rule of Caligula was one of madness and depravity, for he did not understand what his forerunners had, that they may be kings, emperors, but they were mortal men and not gods. However, initially, because of his love for his 3 sisters, things went well for Agrippina. However, after the death of Caligula's favorite sister, Drusilla, he truly descended into madness. Agrippina and other members of their family were exiled after they plotted to assassinate him because they felt his misrule would spark a revolt and lead to the death of them all. The most painful part of this exile was that her young son Nero was taken away to be raised by a distant relative. Emperor Caligula would only live another 18 months until he was assassinated in the year 41, only to be replaced by the most unlikely candidate of all, their father's brother, Uncle Claudius. He was something of a background member of the imperial family because after suffering a severe illness as a child, the lingering effects left him with weak knees that caused him to limp and fall, a terrible stammer, which caused him to slobber as he spoke, and his nose would run in torrents when he became excited. These were treated as veritable deformities by the imperial family, and though he possessed a brilliant mind, he was seen as an embarrassment. Upon ascending to become emperor, he recalled his niece Agrippina from exile and reinstated her standing. Now a young woman, she was intelligent, beautiful, cunning, strategic, and ambitious, every inch an imperial princess. Once in Rome, her thoughts dwelt on finding a new husband that was powerful enough for her to be free from any future threats of exile or punishment based on the whims of whoever in her family happened to sit on the throne. All the while, the prophecy that her son would become emperor and kill her kept running through her mind. Educated, Agrippina understood that these types of oracles could have many meanings, far beyond the obvious, so she resolved that she would facilitate Nero's rise to the throne. While showering him with love and building a bond so strong that the idea of matricide would never enter his mind. Reunited after years apart, she spent every minute she could with her son, never realizing that her overwhelming love and attention were becoming smothering. As it turned out, she was arranged to be married to the most desired bachelor in the empire, Gaius Celestius Crispus Passienus, from a powerful family of consular rank. Obscenely rich, charismatic, and kind, he was loved. And after they were wed, they were the celebrity couple of Rome. You can picture Passienus as a young Brad Pitt in a toga made of the finest linen, and Agrippina as his flawlessly beautiful and classy princess, akin to Angelina Jolie playing Alexander's mother Olympias. They were greeted with cheers and showered in adoration wherever they went. Passienus was a passionate man, who loved soulfully and deeply, but, well, he didn't love his wife. He had a certain type, not blonde or brunette, but green, with a thick trunk. Allow me to explain. He was in love with a sacred tree, who late at night he would bring wine, and then, shall we say, consummate the relationship. When this became known, it was of course embarrassing for Agrippina. But because Passienus was so popular, it was seen as a joke. The people were laughing with him rather than at him. The sacred tree would become famous and visited for centuries to come. Perhaps to make amends, in the aftermath of the scandal, he named his wife as his sole heir and adopted Nero as his own son. Yet within just a short span of time after this, he suddenly died. And once again, the rumors about Agrippina swirled, with the plebs saying, "That girl is poison." Now the richest widow in the empire, she and Nero were taken into the imperial household by her uncle, Emperor Claudius, who had two young children of his own living there, his daughter Claudia Octavia and his son and heir Britannicus, both from his current wife, an empress of Rome, the notorious Valeria Messalina. Recorded by ancient historians as a nymphomaniac whose obscene sexual exploits were known to everyone except her husband, who was blinded by her irresistible charm. And why not? Valeria Messalina could be utterly enchanting, not only to her husband, but to her friends. But as so many of us do, she had a darker side. When Agrippina and Nero came to live in the imperial compound, the empress saw Nero, who by bonds of blood could easily be seen as the true heir of Augustus, a threat to her baby, her joy, her son Britannicus, who had already exhibited symptoms of epilepsy, a disease that was seen as a curse from the gods by most plebs, and would diminish him in their eyes. Then, at the next public games, she witnessed the crowds cheer for Nero far louder than for her son. Thus, it was time to remove this perceived usurper. Messalina dispatched two assassins into Nero's bedchamber. The boy was asleep, so they approached his bed, raised their daggers, and suddenly, next to sleeping Nero's head on his pillow was a hissing viper, a black snake ready to strike. Terrified, perhaps taking it as a warning from the gods, the assassins dropped their daggers and fled. Their metallic clink on the marble floor woke Nero, and he called out in alarm. His slaves came into the room quickly, and soon Agrippina was there, saw the two daggers, and inexplicably the shed skin of a snake on the pillow where her son had slept. The strange omen of the snakeskin aside, Agrippina quickly guessed who had sent the assassins to kill her son, her Nero. Perhaps sick of the rumor spread about her, perhaps tired of being at the mercy of whoever sat upon the throne, perhaps recalling all the lessons taught to her about the rise of her grandmother, the first Empress of Rome, perhaps never wishing to be scared again, and definitely sick of being a pawn in imperial politics. Agrippina resolved to accept the prophecy and make her son emperor, even if it meant her death, for it would mean his safety. And to achieve this, she had to become what they all said she was already. She'd be poison, she'd be dangerous, and her enemies would die. First, the Empress Messalina would have to be brought to ruin, which her reckless behavior would bring about eventually. But Agrippina would encourage and accelerate the process. And when it manifested, she'd be ready to strike. While Messalina became distracted by her love affair with her latest paramour, Agrippina became the embodiment of Augustus's ideal of Roman womanhood. She forswore the heavy makeup, jewelry, and the rich silk and linens that was the fashion in Rome to flaunt one's wealth and status. In her eyes, all these things made women into ornaments, accessories to highlight their husband's power. Instead, she wore the simplest of robes, with no makeup and no lavish oiled ringlets. Instead, her hair pulled back into a simple ponytail. This new simplicity also served to highlight her natural beauty. Then she set about spending as much time with her uncle Claudius as possible, engaging him in deep discussions about his one true love, history, showcasing her intelligence and sharp mind, earning his respect, friendship, and affection. Next, she carefully built connections to the powerful administrators of the imperial court. She was generous and kind to the freedmen and slaves of the household, winning them over, befriending the soldiers and officers of the Praetorian Guard, cultivated close relationships with senators and their wives, and is reported to have begun quietly discrediting and even poisoning a few select people who she knew would oppose her rise. In fear for her safety, she took to sleeping in the same bed as young Nero, which she allowed to become common knowledge, which, as she had predicted, began rumors of incest, which she in turn used to trace to their source, allowing her to identify previously unknown enemies, which she then worked to neutralize. She forced her son to be ever more visible in public life and sought to teach him the tools he would need to lead. However, this overwhelming presence in her son's day-to-day life was slowly causing a rift between them, with young Nero declaring that he had no interest in politics and threatening to run away from home to become an actor several times, a threat as actors were seen as the lowest form of life to the nobility. But she brushed these threats off. And soon, her rival, the Empress, was indeed undone when she either ceremonially or actually married her lover. The freedman, who ran the day-to-day affairs of the empire, reported this incident to Emperor Claudius, who was away from Rome. When Messalina Valeria discovered this, she rushed to meet the returning emperor on the road with her children in tow. She begged him to forgive her. Her words seemed to have softened his anger, and she was told that he needed time to consider. That night, she was executed by a member of the Praetorian Guard, who had been sent by a freedman to order her to take her own life, as honor demanded after such a public insult to her husband and emperor. When she refused and demanded to speak to her husband, the Praetorian murdered her with his gladius. It is unclear if Claudius himself ordered his wife's execution, but when he was informed of it, he had no emotional reaction, instead calling for a carafe of wine. Over the course of the next year, a series of noblewomen were suggested to Claudius as candidates for his next wife, with Agrippina seemingly always in the room because she had worked so hard to become her uncle's best friend and confidant. Whenever she learned of a new proposed bride, she immediately went to work using rumors to discredit and destroy their reputations, even having one banished after Claudius spoke of her beauty and allegedly murdering another with poison. Eventually, despite the advice of his closest advisors against committing actual incest, a charge that was whispered about the imperial family for decades, Emperor Claudius married his niece Agrippina on New Year's Day 49 Common Era. She encouraged her uncle-turned-husband to focus his attention on writing his passion project, A New History of Rome, while she handled the day-to-day affairs of the empire. As he adored her and respected her intelligence greatly, he consented. And as soon as he did, Agrippina went about removing anyone from the imperial court that had spoken against her in the past, Anyone who was still loyal to Messalina and thus Britannicus, even arranging the death of his grandmother, and isolating Britannicus as much as possible from his father or any friends or allies. As she cemented her grip on the imperial court, she made sure that everyone who had access to Emperor Claudius was loyal to her. The emperor soon adopted Nero as his own son, and agreed to Agrippina's demand that Nero be married to his daughter, Octavia, which was arranged despite the objections of the newly engaged couple. With Britannicus marginalized to a large extent, she forced Nero to accept every public office that she could arrange the emperor to give him, so that her son could learn to rule, and so that he was seen at ever more games, festivals, and parades. This despite Nero still having no interest, sparking resentment and more arguments. Agrippina ignored his complaints and told him to use his love of acting in his speeches for him to learn how to control an audience with his voice. Her plans bore fruit as Nero's public profile grew immensely, and soon Claudius made his adopted son his co-heir with Britannicus. Yet because he was older and public-facing, Nero was already being seen by many as their next emperor. In the year 50, Agrippina became only the second living woman to be granted the title Augusta, Empress, apt and earned because in many ways she had become the de facto ruler of the empire. She sat on a golden chair next to the often empty seat of the emperor, who was far too involved in his writing to attend. She made decisions on law and imperial policy, signed public documents, received foreign embassies, through her developed network of allies, influenced and to a large extent controlled the Senate, as well as giving every available important political position to her supporters. And she even replaced the leader of the Praetorian Guard. That same year, as a gift from her adoring husband, a colony was established on the site of her birth, named after her. Colonia Claudia Ara Agrippinensis, or as we know it, modern Cologne in Germany. Statues of her were erected in cities across the empire, and her face appeared on coins. But she still had enemies. Many powerful senators resented her power, feeling that a woman had no right to rule over them. Their wives spreading whispers among the women of Rome, mocking her natural appearance and simple dress, saying that it was an affront to the dignitas of Rome that their Augusta would meet foreigners and dignitaries without displaying the power of the empire in the form of layers of the finest cloth, makeup, and jewelry that every noble woman should wear. Soon it seemed everyone was talking about how unbecoming it was for her to dress so plainly when conducting matters of state. In answer, Agrippina took to wearing a single ornament, a long gold wristband that according to legend was a replica of one worn by Queen Cleopatra of Egypt, provoking her enemies even more by wearing this symbol of power from the demonized foreign queen, who they had been taught to believe had ensorcelled Mark Antony and caused a civil war. In June 53 Common Era, her Nero and Claudius's Octavia were married, confirming in the minds of the people that he was the favored heir to the throne. Yet not long after the wedding, her position and everything she had plotted and worked toward looked about to come undone. Word reached her ears that Emperor Claudius had begun to see his wife as a manipulator who had separated him from his son Britannicus and abused his love for her to make Nero his heir. The emperor began exerting his authority again, was considering ordering the divorce of Nero and Octavia, was about to remove Nero from the line of succession, and officially recognize Britannicus as the sole heir to the empire. Agrippina had to act before any of this became official. The emperor had to die, and it had to look like he died from natural causes so as not to raise any suspicion that she had a hand in it. A clean assassination so that she could fulfill the prophecy and make her Nero the emperor of Rome. And Agrippina knew the gods were with her because she had recently learned of the existence of the most skilled poisoner in the world, who was even now languishing in a prison cell awaiting execution for murder. This is the tale of the rise of one of history's first documented serial killers. The poisonous tale of a quest for power that would end as all such quests seem to, madness. The saga of an empress and a provincial pleb who would alter the course of history and destroy a dynasty. Halloween with your lore master. So take a deep breath, let it out slowly, put some smoke in the air if you choose, And just let your mind flow to my voice as we go deep into Imperial Rome in the first century before the Common Era and experience the dark side of humanity by coming to know the poisoner, assassin, and dealer of death, Locusta of Gaul. In a tale I call, That Girl is Poison. She's dangerous. Welcome. We'll return to Augusta Agrippina's dilemma soon, but first let's learn about her accomplice in her most notorious plot. Far from the imperial core and capital city of Rome, to the north lay the imperial province of Gaul, modern France and the Low Countries, that had been conquered and subjugated by the legions of Julius Caesar a century before. Over the course of many decades, its Celtic people had been Romanized by being integrated into the economy of the empire. This tried and true tactic of cultural conversion through economic dependency worked particularly well with the Celts that lived in towns and what we would call semi-urban environments. Over time, even rural farming settlements came to see the benefits of selling their crops and produce to Roman merchants, who could use the vast web of Roman roads to move their goods at fast speeds to places that were completely inaccessible to them, thus providing them with basic economic stability and growth at the expense of the freedom their ancestors had enjoyed. However, in remote regions, the deep woods, there were Celtic settlements that existed largely unaffected by Roman rule. With no need to trade, no desire to make money, and no desire to give up their relative freedom for the convenience of imperial modernity, such as running water, baths, and access to goods from faraway places, these small sub-tribes more or less existed as they always had. With most of the aggressively religious ancient Druidic sects decimated during or after the conquest, and with others simply dying off, absent new recruits, because the old Gallic hill forts that had supported them for centuries through their offerings that allowed them to seek out a druid who could advise them through their access to the wisdom of the ages, or perform a blood rite to know the will of a certain god from their vast pantheon, but also offer aid for more worldly physical concerns, like a cure for illness and maladies. For druids, through trial and sometimes ghastly error over the centuries, had discovered the effect of every plant, leaf or root thereof, bark and insect that dwelled upon them. Using these natural properties, druids were capable of curing things like headaches, stomach ailments, pain from inflammation, anxiety, and even kill quickly as an act of mercy. However, since their ancient hill forts had been converted into Roman towns, the relatively prosperous populations could just pay a Roman medicus for any ailment. And as for the wisdom of the gods, focused on trade and rising in the imperial economy, the Romanized Celts largely felt that their old gods had been defeated by Jupiter and the gods of the Romans. Why should they risk Roman suspicion and thus possible otherizing by holding on to the ways of their ancestors? So the Druids largely lost the spiritual power of their religion. However, their plant and herb lore was valued and spread in the countryside. As the century after the conquest passed, these rural herb lorists were priceless assets to the distant tribes who populated the hinterlands of Imperial Gaul. What little we know of Locusta's story begins here. Her tribe dwelt in the deep woods of northeastern Imperial Gaul. She was an herb lorist of the highest caliber, with not just incredible knowledge of the uses of known plants for humans, but an incredible ability to discover the properties of new plants and animals she found. Perhaps wishing to avoid having to marry, perhaps wishing to see the wider world, perhaps wishing to use her skills to help more people than those in her tiny settlement, or perhaps, just perhaps, wishing to make a fortune killing Romans. For rumor had it that the nobles of the imperial city had vast lists of enemies that they wished to be rid of. Locusta could already make this happen in dozens of ways. And she was sure that once she learned the properties of the plants and animals that flowed into Rome from its vast empire, she would be able to kill Romans for other Romans in any way their decadent and depraved imaginations could contrive. And in the process, become vastly wealthy herself and be able to truly dictate her own fate on her own terms. So Locusta moved. She arrived in Rome years before her name reached Agrippina's ears. Imagine a young woman from the wilderness entering the metropolis of Rome, the imperial core, with its public buildings, people from all over the world speaking different languages, the villas of the powerful, the hovels of the poor, the scents, the sounds, so alien and would be intimidating to anyone. However, Lacusta had a plan. She made inquiries and found two poisoners, Canidia and Martina, both of whom were in high demand. She either apprenticed with them or joined them as their junior partner as a dealer of death. It is most likely from them that she learned how to use the Roman patronage system to her advantage. Not only were families high up in any Patronus network, likely to have the need of the services of a death dealer, and more importantly, have the denarii to pay for it, but critically, they had the power to save them from the consequences should they be caught. Soon Locusta's unique lethal skills had her in high demand, and her powerful clients were able to get her released from prison time and again. She became rich and infamous until she was caught red-handed, and her patron at the time could not get her out of prison nor protect her from the sentence of death that she received. That is until the most powerful woman in the empire, Augusta Agrippina, desperately needed the services of the woman she had been informed was the best poisoner in all of Rome to kill her husband, the emperor, who she feared was about to move against her, and her son. Agrippina had Locusta secretly brought into the imperial compound and consulted with her. Though she had lost her husband's favor, most of the household, the Praetorian Guard, the slaves, and crucially the emperor's personal attendants were loyal to her. Among these were his doctor and perhaps his food taster, who served to ensure that whatever he ate was not in fact poisoned. It appears that the assassination plot unfolded thusly. Emperor Claudius was given a bowl of his favorite food, mushrooms, and among these were placed the deadly black cap variety. However, with this meal, the emperor drank a lot of wine, and apparently the alcohol numbed the effect of the poison so that instead of death, he became very ill. His doctor Xenophon was called upon to treat him and first administered a, quote, healing enema. The fluid used in this procedure was laced with poison. Even this was not enough to kill him, and Claudius lay in utter agony. Finally, Xenophon suggested the emperor's favored go-to cure for stomach ailments, a feather that he would use to tickle the back of his throat to induce vomiting. But this feather was covered in poison. The result was not death, but that his illness drastically worsened. Only after suffering extreme abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, excessive salivation, low blood pressure, and difficulty breathing for 12 hours, what must have seemed an eternity, the emperor passed on to what comes next on October 13th, 54, Common Era. To ensure that no one could suspect Agrippina of employing Locusta, she was smuggled out of the imperial compound and back into her jail cell, with the Augusta's promise that her death sentence would be commuted. Though the emperor was dead, Agrippina delayed announcing the fact, later claiming that she had to consult an oracle for the most auspicious moment to inform the public that Claudius had departed the mortal coil to ascend to take his place among the gods, when in fact, every second after his death had been calculated. First, she took Nero to the barracks of the Praetorian Guard, where they proclaimed him Imperator, Imperator, Imperator. Then, under their protection, they went to inform the Senate, who proclaimed Nero Emperor. There was some suspicion, but since Nero had the Praetorian Legion on his side, they had to agree. During the funeral, Claudius was deified, which was formally announced during Nero's eulogy, thus making him the son of Claudius the god, enhancing his position. And some senators quietly laughed at this, having known the emperor was far from divine. Not long after Agrippina's son became emperor, he suddenly became very fond of mushrooms, and when he ate, he would call them the food of a god, to resounding laughter from his sycophants. This implies that Nero knew, or at least believed, that his mother had killed his adopted father. Such blatant comments made before the imperial court should have been a warning of what was to come. Agrippina immediately made it clear that she intended to rule beside Nero, and not in the fashion of a junior partner. Among her first acts were to exile or kill anyone with even a remote claim to the throne. But his mother's presence bothered Emperor Nero, who had always felt smothered by her. Ironically, it was a tutor Agrippina had hired to teach him, who she had championed and even arranged for his recall from exile, the famous Stoic philosopher Seneca, who advised the new emperor that women had no place in politics and should never be allowed to wield power. Thus, Agrippina was removed from the imperial compound and sent to live in a country villa. The following year, 55, feeling his hold on power secure, Nero finally decided that it was time to rid himself of Britannicus. He freed Locusta from prison and had her brought to the palace to kill his stepbrother. The historian Suetonius's words, he procured the potion from an arch poisoner, one Locusta, and when the effect was slower than he anticipated, merely physicking Britannicus, he called the woman to him and flogged her with his own hand, charging that she had administered a medicine instead of a poison. And when she said in excuse that she had given him a smaller dose to shield him from the odium of the crime, he replied, "It's unlikely that I'm afraid of Julian law." He forced her to mix as swift and instant a potion as she knew how, in his own room, before his very eyes. Then he tried it on a goat, and as the animal lingered for 5 hours, had the mixture steeped again and again, and threw some of it before a pig. The beast instantly fell dead. Whereupon he ordered that the poison be taken to the dining room and given to Britannicus. The boy dropped dead at the very first taste, but Nero lied to his guests and declared that he was seized with the falling sickness to which he was subject, and the next day had him hastily and unceremoniously buried in the pouring rain. According to legend, the reason Britannicus had to be buried so quickly was that Locusta's poison had turned him a bright blue. And as this took place on the field of the war god, lightning, such as not had been seen in living memory, lit up the sky, signaling the anger of the gods. Thrilled with the end result, Nero officially named Locusta the imperial poisoner, along with a huge amount of denarii, and gifted her with a vast country estate, where she was to spend her days perfecting her craft, discovering the perfect poison to deliver the emperor's exact desired effect. To achieve this, Nero sent her animals from across the empire and hundreds of human prisoners to experiment upon. Once established, she started a school to pass on her knowledge to the next generation of death dealers, all of whom were sponsored by Nero. He used her services often, delighted that Locusta's skill had become so great that he could dictate the manner in which his enemy would die. Long and lingering, immediate, and the exact level of suffering they would experience until they succumbed. However, all was not well at the imperial court. Despite all his attempts to marginalize her, nothing he did reduced the respect in which his mother Agrippina was held. Paranoid, becoming mentally unhinged from wielding unlimited power, he felt that unless she were dead, everyone would think of him as owing his position to his mother. So he decided to have her murdered. There were many plots and multiple attempts, all of which failed. Until after surviving an attempt to drown her in a boat rigged to sink, from which she was able to swim away, her enraged son sent 3 men to her bedchamber to kill her. Agrippina had long ago accepted her fate. She pulled up her gown and instructed the assassins to stab her in the abdomen, because her womb had borne such an ungrateful son. Her death in the year 59 only accelerated Nero's madness, who is said to have been haunted by his mother's ghost, hearing her words on the wind for the rest of his days. His reign as emperor was cruel, murderous, brutal, and at times ridiculous. So just 9 years later, in 68, he was forced to commit suicide after being declared an enemy of the state by the Senate for his misrule. His death, coupled with the murders of every other person with a blood claim on the throne, ended the Julio-Claudian dynasty. The new emperor Galba quickly had the hated imperial poisoner Locusta arrested. The ancient accounts of what happened next are disturbing and graphic, so I'll just say she was either marched through the streets of Rome in chains and beheaded along with the rest of Nero's favorite courtiers, or marched through the streets of Rome in chains, led to an arena, covered in the vaginal juices of a female giraffe, raped by a male giraffe, and then wild animals were released to rip her to shreds. So ended the life of Locusta of Gaul. Serial killer? Mercenary? Death dealer for hire? or just a provincial country woman trying to use the skills that God had given her to make her way in the world? You decide. Thank you for listening to Deep Into History. Please tell everyone you know about this show. I could really use your help, so please consider supporting the show on Patreon, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. You can follow me at Deep Into History on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Blue Sky to get your daily blast from the past. And as always, my dear friend, take care of yourself. I truly look forward to the next time we go deep.